on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Coming up today, a late olive harvest in Tasmania's northwest.
It was a fairly cool summer, and that's had some impact, but I just hope this doesn't keep up in the long term, because once the season gets extended out, the parrots and what have you, they've finished off all the Cotoni asters and finished off all the hawthorn berries, and olives are next on their menu.
And growing Tasmanian juniper berries for the gin industry in the state.
Most junipers in Australia, well, they're all imported, and they come from places like Macedonia and Bulgaria, where it's very mountainous and very hot and very cold, and it seems to resemble the climate in Ouse really, really well. It often gets very cold and very hot in Ouse.
They're growing juniper berries in the Central Highlands and the first big commercial harvest this year. That story coming up on this Monday. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you as we also take a look at the latest olive harvest in the northwest, which is running late, and also the fact the hungry birds are on the hunt for the olive trees. Also today, a look at the carbon credit situation when it comes to farm purchases across the country, like the Rushy Lagoon sale here in Tasmania, and what it's doing to the value of farmland in the rural sector. That story for you in just a moment. We will check the latest on the weather in a bit over 10 minutes from now. You too can be part of the Country Hour with your thoughts via the text line on 0438 922 936. Well, first up today, the area of farmland around the country is shrinking due to urban sprawl and pressure from mining and renewable energy projects, as well as the growth in hobby farming. And there's another reason. Farming land is also being converted back to native vegetation as big corporates buy land to store carbon to offset their emissions. The government itself acts on its plan to protect 30% of the land for nature repair. David Claughton from the Country Hour has been looking into the issue.
Big polluters and foreign investors are paying a high price to buy farming properties around the country to offset their emissions or earn credits. There are also nature repair schemes paying landholders to store carbon and protect biodiversity. And the federal government is also in the market to meet its goal to protect 30% of land for conservation by 2030. This is a big challenge for farming, and I'm joined by Larissa Smith from the Tasmanian Country Hour team. Larry, how are you seeing this play out in your region?
Well, the sale of Tasmania's largest farm in the state's far northeast to the UK's biggest forestry investor has stirred a fair bit of community backlash. Treasurer Jim Chalmers approved the sale last week, which will see the government-backed Clean Energy Finance Corporation contribute $69 million to the overall $143 million forestry platform deal with Gresham House and Aviva investors. Now, Gresham will plant nearly half of the 22,000 hectare property to pine trees for softwood, and it'll generate about 3.2 million ACCUs, or carbon credits, over the life of the project. So that's around 30 years. It's keeping its beef herd, but dairy cows that have been on the farm, a couple of thousand, have been dried off and they've been sent to Victoria. Here's John O'Craven. He's a newly appointed Tasmanian asset manager for Gresham House.
So Gresham is a global forestry business that's in the business of sustainably producing, you know, forestry across the world and having good environmental outcomes and ESG outcomes for both the environment and the community. So we're focused on success and making this work and also engaging the community. We'll have different layers of engagement. We'll also have different layers on the property. I think we want to engage and involve people. Is there tourism opportunities? Is there mountain bike touring? Is there engagement with the local Indigenous community? All of those factors to bring it together will certainly help the community be more confident about the management of Rushy moving forward.
Now, politically, it's been a hot potato. Liberal Senator Richard Colbeck raised his concerns in Parliament recently about the sale of Rushy Lagoon, questioning the use of taxpayers' money for plantations and carbon credits.
We should all learn from the mistakes we made with managed investment schemes 20 and 30 years ago, where there are quite a few stranded assets that were planted because of the money, not because it was the right place to grow trees. And so those lessons should be learnt as well. And I have to say, I'm very concerned that they haven't been, and we're just going down that same path now, not just here in Tasmania, but also in other parts of the country.
That's Liberal Senator Richard Colbeck there, David.
Yes, and so it takes us back to the managed investment schemes, and I've been in this job for quite a long time, or maybe as long as you, and I remember those managed investment schemes and the kind of the dislocation it created in many communities. I remember going to a property in the south of South Australia, and a farming family that had been there for a long time, 100 years or more, and they were walking off the property. They'd sold it to the managed investment scheme. They felt like they were selling out their community.
Yeah, and I think you'll find similar stories right across the country. It really hit a nerve, and I think there's still a little bit of a hangover from that. When this property sale came up, people immediately went back to that time of those failed managed investment schemes, and they certainly didn't want to see those mistakes repeated.
It's not exactly the same, but it's interesting, isn't it, the federal government's involvement here and the questions around, well, is that pushing the price of these properties up and out of the reach of other, like Australian farming companies or, you know, individuals that would like to buy properties?
Well, in this case, in the case of Rushy Lagoon in Tasmania, there were other players bidding for the property, and they felt, and others in the community, our peak body here, Tas Farmers, felt that with government putting in money from the CEFC, that it was distorting the market. There is that sentiment.
Mm. And tell me about Rushy Lagoon. Have you been out there?
I was out there this week. Yeah, it's a vast property, 22,000 hectares, perhaps a bit smaller in scale than some of the other properties on the mainland, but it's pretty stunning. It's 17 kilometres of Bass Strait frontage. It's pretty green at this time of the year. And, you know, back in the day, in the 80s and 90s, it was running in excess of 60,000 sheep, 12,000 cattle, turning off 1,000 bales of wool. It was iconic. It still is iconic. And so I think there is that sense of nostalgia that the community feel very attached to this property that's seen a lot of foreign ownership over the years. It's not the first time a foreign buyer has had Rushy, but it's an important piece of history for Tasmania for sure.
Right. Well, we're seeing this issue play out as well in southern New South Wales. Oil and gas giant Woodside has spent $53 million buying up farms in the region to offset its emissions. And now plantation forestry companies are looking for more land to plant trees to earn credits themselves. Rob DeFegoli, who's the general manager of the Southeast New South Wales Forestry Hub, said the federal government needs to rethink how forestry, carbon interests and graziers can work together.
The flashpoint is due to the high price of carbon that's occurring and the drive for some companies to get to net zero, and seeing buying land and planting trees as a fast way to do that without any really considered land use planning and what the ramifications will be of those trees being planted. So rather than it being a considered land use decision between farming and forestry and how they can work well together, we're getting this rather perverse outcome of trees at whatever cost.
Interesting to see someone from the forestry industry responding in this way, isn't it, Larry?
It is indeed.
Now, 120 farmers and locals attended a community meeting at Bombala just in the last week to raise concerns about how land use change will hollow out their rural communities. And grazier John Murdoch says farmers, this is the issue I was talking to you about earlier, they can't compete with the corporates when they're offering this kind of money.
Anecdotally, probably, yeah, 1.5 to 2 times. It's hard to say. And some of these offers, I mean, the farming community are not even getting an opportunity to compete, i.e. they're going direct to aggregators or large corporates for sale. And, you know, for reportedly and anecdotally considerably large amounts of money, far exceeding the agricultural values that the market would depend on. And this is, I guess, a case where subsidised government effects are increasing land values above what would be ordinarily fair market price.
You've had meetings with the government around this issue. What's been the response when you've raised these concerns?
The response has been genuine surprise. The messaging thus far is that this was not how this policy was designed to work, and that this policy is working in Western New South Wales. Why it's not working here is because the land is more productive. It has a higher rainfall. It can yield more. Therefore, the incentives placed on by the government are magnified. In their models, it yields more carbon. Whether that does on the ground or not is somewhat irrelevant. And so therefore, you know, there's market pressures that are falsely imposed on these corporations to get in here, and the incentive is to get in quickly and lock down these projects. And so this is a snowballing effect now as they become more and more aware of the need to do this.
So companies like Woodside, they're among that sort of the big 200 polluters that under the safeguard mechanism have to, if they can't reduce their emissions, they've got to offset them. And that's why they're out there chasing, you know, these rural properties to plant trees and maybe turn some of them into native vegetation. Now, Dr. Samantha Andres did a study for this for the Hawkesbury Institute for the Environment in Western Sydney University, and she said a lot of the land being bought for nature repair is in marginal areas where the land's cheaper, and she says that's not necessarily helping repair the environment.
They bought a bunch of land and they're planting a bunch of woody species on it. They're native, I'll give them that. You know, the Tasmanian example you gave me is completely different. They're planting pine in an area that can't support pine, that's never had pine on it. But in the case of the Woodside example, they've bought a bunch of land that was historically native grassland, and they're planting woody species on it. And so, you know, afforestation, which is the planting of species where, you know, tree-dominated ecosystems where trees never existed, isn't necessarily going to be the right answer either to you know, dealing with sequestering carbon. And there's still research that's kind of coming out that's showing that, you know, old growth grasslands actually hold a lot of carbon in the soil. And so...
So they should be doing something different with those properties, do you reckon?
Yeah, I would think so. You know, I see the value in planting woody species if that's the reference ecosystem that was once there. But to put something back had never existed there in the first place for the purpose of carbon sequestration or biodiversity doesn't make sense, you know? Putting the right native species in the right place is, it's all about the right plants in the right place.
So both of these examples that we've been talking about, Larissa, whether it's Rushy Lagoon or if it's in the Monero in New South Wales, maybe even in Western New South Wales, we haven't got too many details yet, but the concern is that maybe forestry isn't the solution here if you're actually trying to reduce the carbon emissions, you know, in the atmosphere, because you've got to harvest those trees.
That's right, but then the argument is if it's turned into building materials, it's staying in the environment, it's staying in
its
stable form,
in the timber, yeah,
rather than for chip. But it's interestingly, in Tasmania, Private Forest Tasmania, which is sort of the body that supports farmers to grow trees on farms, is encouraging farmers to look into tapping into the carbon credit market. If you've got an existing plantation, take a look at it. They want farmers to grow more trees and build the forestry estate in Tasmania. So,
well, the great benefit of it is that actually this could provide, you know, the resource that's needed for a sustainable forestry industry. And it does provide an income that's in a dry time, for example, could keep farmers going, you know, getting through difficult times, and you can stack these credits up. So there are some real positives for farmers.
And yeah, it's an annual income, isn't it?
Yes. Well, thanks, Larissa.
Thanks, David.
That's Larissa Smith, the rural reporter in Launceston in northern Tasmania.
Yeah, David Claughton there from New South Wales Country are speaking with Larissa Smith about the carbon credit scheme and how it's impacting farmland values across the country, including here in Tasmania. Jason on the text line says, "G'day, Tony. Regarding trees on Rushy, remember years ago Tema Farm on the far northwest coast got planted. What happened? Didn't grow, and now back to cattle country. We are slow learners. Happy days, Jason. Thank you for that. 0438 922 936 if you'd like to comment. Let's check the latest on the weather now. Tom Anderson joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Tom.
G'day, Tony.
What's the weather doing at the moment?
At the moment, we're still just getting by. We got a little bit of cloud cover, some higher stuff across the state. We're still waiting the arrival of a trough that we've got coming. It's going to impact the west coast this afternoon and bring some rainfall. Ranges roughly between 5 or 10 millimetres today. In terms of some of the population centres at the moment, we're looking at 15 degrees currently in Hobart. We're looking at 14 on Flinders Island, King Island and Strawn, also 14, 13 degrees at the moment for Devonport, Wynyard and St Helens, and Launceston is 11 degrees.
What areas will be affected by the coming rain?
Mostly about the west coast. We will see rainfall over the next week affecting a lot of Tasmania. So a lot of the northern districts are probably looking to receive between 10 and 30 millimetres. And obviously that west coast area will get the most of it. The east coast, as per usual in this westerly wind regime, will miss out mostly. So looking ranges there more between 5 and 10 millimetres over the next few days. We will also see temperatures drop a lot with the passage of another front coming on Wednesday into Thursday. So on Thursday, we're going to see most of the maximum temperatures across the state getting below 10. Launceston may get to 11, but we will see with these very cold temperatures, we'll see the snow level drop a lot, as low as 200 metres for parts of the southwest, and still only as low as 400 metres in the northeast. So there's a possibility of some snow showers coming on Thursday. With that, we would expect to have a road weather alert out, at least for the Midlands Highway, coming on Thursday. So we haven't issued that yet. We'll just see how that is going to develop. Otherwise, with warnings at the moment, all we have is coastal wind warnings for strong winds out for the upper east coast, and then for the central west, southwest and southeast coast, that'll change tomorrow to just be the central west coast and the southwest coast. And with that, on the coastal waters tomorrow, we're looking at west to northwesterly winds 10 to 20 knots for much of the state, possibly tending further towards the north by the afternoon. We will see winds up to 20 to 30 knots for the western waters during that afternoon period as well. And with that, the swells are going to be a 2 to 3 metre west to southwesterly swell for the west and south coasts. About the north, we're still going to see that westerly swell under 1 metre, and on the east coast, we're going to see southerly swell, between 1 and 2 metres.
So pretty wintry conditions for most of the week. What about the weekend?
Yep, so once we see this system come through Thursday into Friday, we'll see the showery activity somewhat persist. It will weaken off into the weekend, so we'll start seeing those rainfall values drop. The cold temperatures will start to ease. We won't see them disappear entirely, but we are expecting to see back up to the low to mid-teens by the weekend. Still have relatively windy conditions, but at this stage, Saturday is probably going to be the best of the days from Wednesday onwards. So, yeah, not the best weekend ahead, but at least the worst of the weather is going to come midweek.
Good on you, Tom. Thanks for that.
Thanks, Tony.
Cheers. Tom Anderson from the Bureau with the latest information for you on the Country Hour. In just a moment, we will go to the Central Highlands and juniper berries being grown.
New from ABC Music.
4 CDs of highlights from this year's Classic 100. The ABC Classic 100 Greatest of All Time Highlights album. Available now on the ABC Classic website.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Don't forget that text number 0438 922 936. A Central Highlands farming couple have completed their first harvest of a niche crop for a growing Tasmanian industry. Chris and Jenny Cosgrove planted a crop of juniper berry trees on their property at Ooze, and so far the experiment is going well. Chris Cosgrove spoke about the thriving local Tasmanian gin industry and why the decision was made to plant the juniper berries.
Well, back in about 2019, 2018, we thought that it was surprising that in a state that takes provenance so seriously, there was a lot of distilleries, a lot of gin, the essential ingredient in gin wasn't grown in Tasmania. So we thought we'd give it a go.
How's it gone?
Yeah, really well, surprisingly well. Most junipers in Australia, well, they're all imported, and they come from places like Macedonia and Bulgaria, where it's very mountainous and very hot and very cold. And It seems to resemble the climate in Ooze really, really well. It often gets very cold and very hot in Ooze. And so far, they're 6 years old now, our trees, and they're thriving.
And you had your first full-on harvest this year?
We did, yeah. We picked the very first small batch, about 5 or 6 kilos we picked last year, but this year was the first proper pick, I guess. And we, picked enough to sell to several distilleries, and we expect to see them, those junipers being used in gin over the coming months. Some are already being used and getting really, really good feedback, and we'll just hopefully grow from here.
How tough are the bushes to grow? Are they a bush?
Yeah, they're a conifer. They're very hardy. They're actually very, very prevalent in the northern hemisphere. They grow everywhere, but they, like all plants, they grow better in certain conditions. So we've found, again, you need to have a really good frost. You need to have a lot of heat as well, and just enough water. You don't need heaps, but you do need a little bit of water on them. So they're not that hard to grow, we found anyway. The tricky part is harvesting them. They're very prickly trees, and they're pretty, and they're a bit hard to harvest, and then you've got to sort them and wash them and everything. But the growing's not too bad.
So that's a work in progress, the harvest.
It is, yeah. Well, in the wild, but in Europe they're collected literally by people who walk out in the wild and hit the trees with a stick, and the ripe cones or the ripe berries fall off, and the unripe ones stay on. That's kind of what we're replicating. But yes, it's very much like everything we're doing, because I think we're the first, or one of the first, where we're learning as we go.
Where did you source the trees from?
I came from a nursery in South Australia, so went through the appropriate, import requirements here to Tassie, and we put them in as a COVID project in 2020.
How many did you put in, and have you got plans for expansion, or is that a wait and see?
Yeah, we've got a few hundred in now, and we've just put in another 500 or 600 now. So we've got, that's probably close to 1,000 trees currently. And that'll do us for now. My wife and I, we both work full-time jobs. The farm's about an hour from Hobart, so it's manageable to get up there on weekends and that sort of thing. But that's about what we're going to do for now.
And what's the difference with junipers, and why the necessity to have them as part of a drink? Of gin. Is that just tradition?
Well, no, it's a requirement. So gin is basically flavoured alcohol, right, or flavoured ethanol. So a base spirit, which is your vodka or something like that, which is just nothing else in it. That's what you start with, or ethanol. To make gin, it has to have juniper in it. So the Dutch word for juniper is juniver. That's where we get our word gin from, 200 or 300 years ago when the Dutch took gin into England. And most distilleries will put in a lot of other botanicals as well, whether that's cinnamon or orange or cardamom or whatever, or some of the natives we see here. You see a lot of mountain pepperberry and other things used here in Tassie. But you can put it whatever you like in, but if you don't put juniper in, it's not gin.
Have you tasted the berries?
Yeah, I have. Yeah. I've tasted several of the distillers who are doing who are using our junipers and are doing small batches. Are trying just as a juniper-only gin, so not putting anything else in. They're saying, well, if we're showcasing Tassie junipers as the base note, let's just let it be the hero and do nothing else. And to me, that it tastes fantastic. It's amazing how different it is when you taste different gins side by side. So we've done that. But also, the junipers, some of the offcuts, the prunings are going to a perfumer here in Hobart who's using that to distill juniper essence for a perfume. So I've smelled our junipers as well in a room spray or in a spritz. There's a brewery who's using some of the seconds, if you like, in beers. So I've tasted our juniper beer, and you can use junipers in cooking as well. So we do that a little bit as well. So yeah, I've tasted and smelled our junipers in many different environments.
Now, for people who may not have had anything to do with junipers apart from having a quiet sip every now and then, what do they taste like?
They're an acquired taste. They're very they're a conifer, right? So the typical sort of tasting notes you get a piney and woody and those sorts of flavors. So in cooking they're used very, very sparingly because they are very strong. But they are used in things like northern European cooking, slow cooked meats and braises and that sort of stuff. But a very piney taste. But the cool thing is, and we do this whenever someone comes to the farm or whenever we do samples, if you pick up a juniper berry, a ripe berry, and squish it, you smell it, and what you get is that pure gin smell straight away. And it's, everyone's eyes light up, and it's, the light bulb drops that the penny drops. Sorry, that you know, that's where gin comes from. It's a pretty cool thing to watch.
So the distilleries, you know, beating a path to the doors, the phone ringing hot.
Well, it's ringing. we've got an upgrade. I mean, because you know we've got, as I said, 1,000 trees. Only a few hundred are producing now. That's a drop in the ocean. Having said that, they are, you know, they're tough to grow, and they're tough to harvest. And yeah, we don't have heaps to sell, but we'll have a few more in years to come. So yeah, so we'll never be able to supply all the distillers, but we've got enough that we can keep them happy. And yeah, and the distillers are learning as they go as well. They have never used fresh junipers or juniper straight off the tree. They've always come imported, dried, you know, a year or so old. So they're learning how to play with them and how to work with them as well, and if indeed they're any good or not. So far the feedback's very good, and we hope that continues. But the distillers are, yeah, as I say, they're learning as they go as well. But we think there's a pretty compelling proposition there for distillers and for others to have Tasmanian gin made with the Tasmanian base note grown here in Tassie.
And are there any plans for yourself and your partner to do your own gin?
No, there's not. I've been in agriculture long enough that I know how hard it is to it's hard enough to grow something, and it takes a whole different skill set to make something, to make a product, and then it takes a whole different skill set to market it. So to be able to do all three of those things at once, it's really hard. So I'm happy just to grow them and give them to people who know what they're doing to make it and market it.
Central Highlands juniper berry grower Chris Cosgrove talking about their first big harvest of berries for the local gin distilling industry. Still to come on today's edition of the Country Hour, a late olive harvest in Tasmania's northwest, and a farmer happy with the wind turbines on farm. First up, let's check the latest news headlines with Loretta Lieberger.
Good afternoon, Tony. Inaugural Tasmania Devils AFL coach Ken Hinckley says the club will aim to bring the best talent to the state. Hinckley, who coached Port Adelaide from 2013 until last year, was this morning officially announced as the club's head coach. Social Services Minister Tanya Plibersek has accused One Nation leader Pauline Hanson of palling around with criminals, as the federal government says she's trashing Australia overseas. Last week, Senator Hanson appeared on the Tommy Robinson podcast for an interview with the far-right commentator, whose criminal history includes prison sentences for fraud and assault. Thousands of people have gathered in the Indian capital New Delhi ahead of a planned march to demand accountability in the country's education system. Supporters of the youth-led cockroach movement are calling for the resignation of the education minister over exam paper leaks, which have forced millions of students to retake competitive university entrance exams. And the Cook Islands is on high alert after New Zealand's detection of the deadly H5 strain of bird flu. The South Pacific Nations Ministry of Agriculture says it's taking a precautionary approach by increasing public awareness and may restrict poultry imports from New Zealand if the virus is found in domestic flocks. More news at 1 o'clock.
I'm Maureen McGillicuddy.
And I'm Edith Vale.
And we host Another Cuppa,
where we natter away with some of Australia's biggest names.
Pop the kettle on with Granny Bingo.
Woke garbage.
Exactly.
Search Another Cuppa podcast on ABC Listen.
On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
It's been a very average year for olives in Tasmania. In some areas, the season is around 2 months late. Despite that, boutique processor Cradle Coast Olives are in the thick of processing the olives at the moment. Beck Pridham caught up with Tony and Carol O'Neill at their olive farm in the northwest.
Well, at the moment, we're just pressing some olives through an olive press, which consists of a malaxer or a hammer mill, which smashes the olives up. They drop down into a malaxer, which is like a very slow-turning washing machine, which separates the oil out from the cellular structure of the olives. And in the malaxer, we sometimes have to add a little bit of water, although we don't like doing that. But this year is sort of a bit of a horrible year for olives. They're fairly desiccated and fairly low in water content, so we've got to manage that fairly carefully. So in the malaxer, you have a little bit of water helping get the mix going, together with some talc, industrial talc, to help separate the oil out. And we add a little bit of enzyme as well, which is present in the ripe olive, but that helps loosen the oil and helps it to flow. The enzyme is actually made from mushrooms, but both the talc and the enzyme, they're pressing aids as opposed to additives, so there's no impact on the oil whatsoever. The talc gets thrown out and the enzyme is already there. After the malaxer has worked for an hour or so, it's pumped into the centrifuge, and in the centrifuge the oil is separated out from the waste. Hopefully oil comes out one end of the centrifuge and the waste goes out the other end into the trailer and up into the paddocks.
And these olives that you're pressing at the moment, they're not yours, are they? You're doing
no,
it for...
We're pressing Wesley Vale olives at the moment, and they're a little bit of a challenge because of the desiccation, but all the olives so far this year have been a bit of a challenge, and I think this is about pressing number 35 or 36 we've done. So, and the season in Tassie is, in some areas, it's 2 months to 10 weeks late, which is quite remarkable.
Why is that?
Well, I don't really know. It was a fairly cool summer, and that's had some impact. But I just hope this doesn't keep up in the long term, because once the season gets extended out, the parrots and what have you, they've finished off all the Cotoni asters and finished off all the hawthorn berries, and olives are next on their menu. So the parrots are starting to have a little bit of an impact around the place now, so it's a bit of a shame.
They've got quite a sophisticated palate, it sounds like.
They do. And unfortunately, they waste the olive itself. They only go for the pip and crack the pip open and take the kernel out of the pip. So they're a very wasteful exercise as well.
You've got your own trees here. Are you harvesting at the moment as well?
Yes, we are. We're just harvesting. It's still a little bit early for them, but at the moment we just have to get them off before the winter gets too severe and the parrots get too severe.
What do all these things mean for your yield this year, do you think?
Yeah, the yield, the median yield this year is about 14%, and normally that's probably closer to 20%. So, you know, you're looking at 25 to 30% less yield from the olives this year.
And where do your olives go generally?
We have our cellar door here, and mainly cellar door and online sales. But this year we ran out fairly quickly. That was contributed to in no small way the fact that one of our varieties, Manzanillo, took out the Phenolic Champion Award at the International Olive Awards. And, of course, people are chasing polyphenols. So when that went online, it just evaporated fairly quickly. So that hasn't helped us in terms of keeping our supplies up.
The Bureau of Meteorology recently declared an El Nino season. You've mentioned that there's been a couple of difficulties, this one you've just had. How do you see that playing out for you here?
Well, for those with non-irrigated groves, it could be an issue. If it's hotter and warmer, it's going to help us. We have plenty of water on hand coming out our ears, actually, creeks and dams and springs and what have you. And we gravity feed our olives, so we've got plenty of water to spare. So we're fortunate. The drier groves, they'll still get very nice oil. And overall, I'd tend to think it will probably assist the olive industry in Tassie overall.
What are they looking like, the ones that you have harvested? How does that compare to what you'd call a healthier season?
Our oil yields are down. We're probably like 10 or 12% oil. We're probably down at 6 or 7% in the variety we have pressed. We're hoping, and that was Manzanillo, so that is a table fruit or an oil fruit. So when we do the little paragon across the creek, we should get a better return on of olive oil on those because it's a pure oil variety.
Now, you're quite a olive oil connoisseur. What goes into a good olive oil?
What goes into a good olive oil? Oh.
Other than olives, of course.
Yes, well, that's right. Good olives goes into good olive oil. And picking them at a premium, if you pick them too green, it's a very bitter oil. It's green. But after all these years, 20-odd years of picking and pressing olives and making olive oil, Tony's got it down to perfection.
Yeah, that's Carol and Tanya O'Neill from Cradlecast Olives at their olive farm in Tasmania's northwest, talking there to Beck Pridham about the latest harvest. Well, we all suffered with the Telstra outages recently, and they have been increasing across the country year on year, going up by nearly 2,000 incidents in just 12 months, despite the telco receiving a 31% increase in profits in that same time period. Jane McNaughton reports after Friday's Senate Environment and Communications References Committee hearing into the mass Telstra outage earlier this month.
In 2024, Telstra had 3,641 reception outages. That number jumped to 5,221 by 2025. That's just one of the facts that came out during a federal Senate grilling of Telstra on Friday after a widespread outage on July 8th that left thousands of Australians unable to make phone calls or access their data. Here's Green Senator and Committee Chair Sarah Hanson-Young questioning Chief Executive of Telstra, Vicky Brady.
We've been given the figures that you had 3,641 outages in 2024 and 5,221 in 2025. Why are we getting more of them at a time when Australians are relying on their mobile phone service more than ever?
So a number of factors can come into play, and we can take it away and give some more detailed analysis behind that. Just to certain things in a year can affect it. So weather events, if we have a particularly bad period in terms of cyclones, bushfires, various events that can either affect our network or take power out for long periods of time. The single biggest cause of outages on our network relates to power. And so there is absolutely a reliance on making sure that we get continuity and consistency of power. If I could add one other thing. So they relate to, I think, single site outages are included in there. Over the last 12 months, we've actually invested, as Michael said, over several years in better resilience in our network. In fact, our customer impacting minutes from major incidents are actually down 91%, and our time to restore is down 22%. So our internal measurement of this would show the investment and steps we're taking are improving resilience of our network.
In those 2 years that I quoted, in 2024, your annual report recorded a net profit after tax of $1.8 billion. In 2025, you recorded a net profit after tax of $2.3 billion, a 31% increase. And yet, what we've seen here is that in this same period, people's mobile phones are not working more. There are more outages, and yet you've had a 31% increase in your profits. I mean, you can understand why Australians are a bit frustrated here.
Chair, I can understand the frustration you're expressing, but to be clear, through the investment we've made in our network, in fact, the resilience has improved and the customer impact in minutes have come down.
Last week proves that to be an absolute furphy, Ms. Brady. I mean, for whatever you say, we have spent, this committee has been investigating this particular issue since September last year. All of the warning signs were there. And I remember having you and your representatives before this committee, knowing that Optus had had this terrible outage, and you're all pretty smug about it. Oh, that's an Optus problem. Well, I'm sorry. Today we see it's not an Optus problem. It's also a Telstra problem. So when you're banking huge increases in profit, there are more outages, less reliability for people to access and use their mobile phone. I don't think it washes to go around telling people that your system's resilient. It's clearly not.
That was Green Senator and Committee Chair Sarah Hanson-Young. Ross Cadell from the Nationals continued to question Telstra's Chief Executive, Vicky Brady, about their reception coverage maps across regional Australia.
What we're not checking is you've recently had to change your coverage maps after some recent action on from the 3G rollout. There, I'm getting anecdotal stuff. I'm a nat. We got regional guys. They were anecdotally telling me they didn't have range, same places on their farm, same place on their paddocks that they had with a 3G phone. And I think it's all because of the wavelength or the spectrum in which you're sending the thing out. How do these people now who've bought phones and relied on phones and been there with the change in coverage match the change in reception, get 000 from a field? They were previously able to get reception under 3G if they are injured, if they are damaged in their tractor, if their devices go. How do we track people who can't? There is no way to triple zero on range anymore, given the coverage map change, is there? If you're outside range.
I think there's two parts there, if I could just comment, Senator. The coverage map changes was a change to the standard in how we predict and demonstrate and show our coverage on maps. We absolutely worked with customers. Some customers experienced changes in terms of how their experience was, where they were, and we worked with a lot of customers on that. We've also, obviously there will be, we've got a big land mass.
Yep.
There's a lot of the country that doesn't have mobile coverage. We're the only operator that has invested in and brought satellite to mobile texting to our customers. Now, you can't text 000, but at least you can text someone in the event you're outside mobile coverage.
That's the Chief Executive of Telstra, Vicky Brady, ending that report by Jane McNaughton from the Senate hearings on Friday after the Telstra outages recently. Well, a Western District farmer in Victoria who has had wind turbines on the property since 2018 says he's only had positive experiences. Peter Coy has 15 turbines on the farm and uses the revenue from one of those turbines to fund a scholarship to support regional young people to attend university. He says his property was an ideal location for the turbines.
It was fortunate for me that our property for the Western District is notorious for its wind anyhow, so ideal. But we've got a sort of an offshoot from the Grampians running through, which is an elevated ridge about 400 or 600 feet above the surrounding plains, and it's like an aeroplane wing. The wind accelerates over this ridge that runs north and south, and the prevailing westerlies, they found it was a good site for a wind farm.
And did you weigh up the pros or any cons at the time, Peter, or were you keen from the outset?
I did. It was early days. There was a wind farm down on the coast, but I used to drive past that. I must say, I always liked to look at wind farms, and they fascinated me. And when they proposed putting one at Salt Creek, our property, I did have a ram client near Ararat that had an early wind farm there. And I went and said, you know, have you been any problems or has the noise annoyed you? And he did say he did hear it occasionally. And he said the noise was very similar to the waves breaking if you're living on the coast. He said he found it rather comforting when he was going to bed. And, I proceeded without too many worries, really, and said I was very, very keen to go ahead.
So you've had these turbines since, I think, 2018. What have they meant for you financially?
Well, of course, they've made a big difference. As most farmers know, we have our good years and bad years, and to have an income source that's not related to weather and commodity prices is certainly a privilege. And it's meant that we've been able to go ahead and, like all farmers, I think most farmers have debt, buying out family, et cetera, et cetera. So to have a positive income stream has meant that we've been able to establish this scholarship, which the family have got a lot of joy out of, and also infrastructure. We've built ourselves a modern wool shed, and pretty much with the proceeds of the wind farm. So it's been very beneficial financially, but also they've put in some really good roads across this really rough, stony country that is about a third of the property, that has made it so accessible. And of course, from a fire prevention point of view, it was country you couldn't get into before, whereas if there's a lightning strike or something happens now, you know, we've got a very good chance of stopping the fire up in this country before it gets out.
The scholarship you mentioned, that's where you take some of the revenue from having the turbines and you provide scholarships for regional young people to head off to university for study?
That's right, that's right. And that's been so successful because there have been 8 students now from all local students, and pretty much all of them would have had a lot of difficulty getting to university. They were academically qualified, but it's so much more expensive for a country kid to go to a Melbourne or Geelong university, where they've got the extra overhead of accommodation and living away from home expenses. So this has been very rewarding. We put up the proceeds of one wind turbine, which was $15,000, and it's been adjusted since. And to my delight, the Tilt Renewables, the wind farm people, said that was a good idea and they'd match it. So the scholarship's worth about $38,000 a year at the moment. And it just enables kids from the country, and they've all been kids that have really needed the help. It's changed lives, and they've been able to go to university and not have to sort of work, you know, in jobs all over the place the whole time to try and finance their education. It's been very, very rewarding.
And Peter, in the current setting, the debate around renewables on farms has become really heated, really divisive. There are large sectors of parts of communities completely opposed to renewables being built on farmland. What do you make of that current debate?
Yeah, well, look, that's very true, Angus, but what I'll be talking about at Orange, I'll be really talking about my experience and how the wind farmers affected the local community and ourselves and the scholarship, etc. And it's really been all positive. So I'll be speaking purely on our experience without getting involved in the debate and putting our very positive side forward. Honestly, I do believe that we'll be on the right side of history. This little wind farm of ours, I think, is the equivalent of powering 30,000 homes or 60,000 cars, I think, off the road. So if you feel good about having an electric car, you feel so much better if you've got 60,000 electric cars. So I'd encourage people to go along to the conference and hear some positive stuff about renewable energy.
That was Peter Coy, a farmer from the Western Districts of Victoria, speaking with Angus Furley about the wind turbines on his property. And Peter will be speaking at the National Renewables in Agriculture Conference, which will be held in Orange in New South Wales in the next month. Okay, coming up in a moment, we'll talk truffles.
Beneath the heat and dust lies gemstones, secrets and murder.
This is homicide.
Nothing stays buried forever. The suspenseful new crime drama, Treasure and Dirt. Streaming now on ABC iView.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, there's generally not much harvesting happening in winter. However, if you're into the pungent, fancy fungi known as truffles, you'll be happy to know they're in full season. Growers are in the midst of harvest, and at the foot of the Victorian snowfields, a brother and sister have been digging up the rare white variety. And this has been a good year, with some of their truffles retailing for more than $1,500 each. Annie Brown has the story.
It's a cold, wet morning in Buffalo Creek. I'm on a cattle farm at the foot of Mount Buffalo, although you can't even see it as it's hidden behind fog.
He's all right to come out.
Brother and sister Sergio Parasotto and Lisa Lupino are digging for truffles, which is a fairly new venture on the family farm.
Is it like garlic? Is that what I'm smelling?
Yeah.
Earth, garlic, and a bit of dirt, but once they're cleaned up...
Yeah.
It was... I don't know, I enjoyed truffles. I've had them in restaurants, some overseas, some in Melbourne, and I just thought, well, why don't we try growing truffles? And my brother looked at me and thought, it's a bit weird. Anyway, so we researched it, looked at the soil, if it was suitable, had soil testing done and etc. And that's what, started it all. It was just a spur of the moment type sort of talking, you know, what are we going to do with this extra little bit of land? And that's what we started,
So this is just one of the things that you produce out here on this farm. You also do hazelnuts. We've got, people can probably hear the cattle in the background as well. So this is just maybe something a bit different to try out?
Yes, it was, yeah. So we've obviously got the cattle and, we do hazelnuts. The trees that some of the truffles are grown under, apart from the hazelnuts, are stone pine, which actually produce pine nuts. Yeah, and then, we just maintain the whole farm because we love doing it. We love being out here.
Australia is the world's fourth largest truffle producer, heavily concentrating on the French black winter truffle. In Buffalo Creek, Sergio says they also grow the rare white variety.
They reckon it's hard to grow, but I found it quite simple. Lime levels, water, very important.
and also where you are in the country. So if you look in, like in town, it's a lot warmer than we are out here. We're always like 3 or 4 degrees cooler than, and that's ideal for the white truffle. Where the black, same sort of scenario, plenty of water. Lime is a big factor in that as well. And soil types, sandy, the better.
And tell me a bit about the white truffles, because these are a bit rarer, a bit more unique to truffle growing. You know, what's different about them to the black ones, other than the colour, I guess, obviously?
Yeah, so the white truffle has a distinct flavour. They have this, I'm going to say, like a garlic, earthy smell to them and taste. You don't actually cook with the white truffle. You actually just shave it or grate it on top of the food, like a nice pasta, you know, just a plain based pasta, not like a bolognese or anything like that. The heat from the food activates the actual white truffle, and that's where you get your flavour from. And it's very delicate, like when you're handling it and things like that. It's not as robust as the black, so we're very careful when we actually harvest them, because they can actually break and very quickly and easily, yeah. As you've probably seen when we just picked one. Yes. Yeah. So
truffles are known for fetching a premium price, and Lisa says because the white ones are so rare, they are even more expensive.
So white truffles are, the going price at the moment is $3.50 a gram, whereas your black is $2.50 a gram.
Wow. And so the white truffle that we just dug up a couple minutes ago, how much would that weigh?
That would probably be close to a 50 to 60 gram.
Some quick math, 50 grams times $3.50 equals $175, which is not bad for one truffle. But it gets better. Recently, they dug up a white truffle weighing in a whopping 464 grams. That retails for $1,624. For now, truffles have been a successful winter side hustle for the siblings, and they encourage more people to have a go.
Like, there's a lot of people who have tried this game and haven't succeeded. Do your homework. Water availability, soil structure, it's a great little hobby to have if you enjoy farming. And good luck to anyone who got a few bucks to throw away and have a crack at it. But it's well worth it in the end, I hope. Yeah.
Should try it at home. Backyard truffle growing. That's Sergio Parisotto from Buffalo Creek in northeast Victoria, adding that report from Annie Brown on the winter truffle harvest. Okay, that's the Country Hour for today. I'll put a podcast of the program up and another Country Hour after midday tomorrow.